Our text this week is Psalm 25. Yes, another theme of dealing with trials, crying out to God in the midst of them. We covered that last week in Psalm 3. But we have a different angle that this psalm takes and some beautiful truths we all need to hear, whether we're in the midst of trials now or not, because if we're not now, they will come. And if we're not now, it's incumbent upon you to look for those who are, so you can share their struggle with them and know the kinds of comfort the Lord wants us to have. I think many of the times we look at the different psalms that deal with crying out to God in trial, a lot of the main point is, why do you fail to cry out? Why do you walk this alone? Cry out, the Lord will hear you. I don't want to belittle that point one bit. But I think what this psalm helps us do is not so much just point out that we should cry out, but it shows us how. When we're in the midst of trial and we cry out to God, what should that cry consist of? This psalm is a beautiful picture of what that should be. Hear now the word of the Lord, Psalm 25. To you, O Lord, I lift up my soul. O my God, in you I trust. Let me not be put to shame. Let not my enemies exult over me. Indeed, none who wait for you shall be put to shame. They shall be ashamed who are wantonly treacherous. Make me to know your ways, O Lord. Teach me your paths. Lead me in your truth and teach me, for you are the God of my salvation. For you I wait all the day long. Remember your mercy, O Lord, and your steadfast love, for they have been from of old. Remember not the sins of my youth or my transgressions. According to your steadfast love, remember me. For the sake of your goodness, O Lord, good and upright is the Lord. Therefore, he instructs sinners in the way. He leads the humble in what is right and teaches the humble his way. All the paths of the Lord are steadfast love and faithfulness for those who keep his covenant and his testimonies. For your name's sake, O Lord, pardon my guilt, for it is great. Who is the man who fears the Lord? Him will he instruct in the way that he should choose. His soul shall abide in well-being, and his offspring shall inherit the land. The friendship of the Lord is for those who fear him, and he makes known to them his covenant. My eyes are ever toward the Lord, for he will pluck my feet out of the net. Turn to me and be gracious to me, for I am lonely and afflicted. The troubles of my heart are enlarged. Bring me out of my distresses. Consider my affliction and my trouble, and forgive all my sins. Consider how many are my foes, and with what violent hatred they hate me. Oh, guard my soul and deliver me. Let me not be put to shame, for I take refuge in you. May integrity and uprightness preserve me, for I wait for you. Redeem Israel, O God, out of all his troubles. The word of the Lord. Okay, kids, all eyes up here and all ears up here too. God loves you guys, and he has made this time to be for you too, not just the adults. And he wants you to know how much he loves you, but he wants you to know how you can love him too, right? So, have you ever walked on ice before? Not like an ice cube, but if a pond is frozen or maybe a puddle is frozen, have you ever walked on it before? Yes? Okay. What do you have to be careful of if you walk on ice? If it might do what? Break, right? So if first of all, you have to find out if your mommy and daddy allow you to walk on the ice. But if you're allowed to, what do you have to do first before you go stand on it? You have to test it, right? Maybe put one foot on it, maybe a little bit of your weight, and then maybe all of one foot, and then maybe you can stand on it. But you have to make sure it doesn't crack, right? If it cracks, what's going to happen to you? You're falling in and you could even die, right? That's a scary thing. So you got to be careful. Make sure the ice doesn't break. You have to test it first, right? Have you guys ever come in here and been afraid that the floor would break and you'd fall through into the ground? No, that's kind of silly, isn't it? Do you have to test this floor to make sure it doesn't break before you walk on it? No, why do you not have to test it? Because you've been on this floor 100 times, right? It's made of good, hard cement. so you can run on it and play. You know it's not going to break, right? Let me ask you this. Some people would say if it break, someone would say the floor failed. It failed, it means it didn't work right, right? Well, this floor has never failed you, right? So you don't have to worry that it's going to break, right? If I see you worried the floor's going to break, I'm probably going to laugh. That's a little bit silly, right? I say, what are you worried about? The floor's not going to break. Has God ever failed you? Has God ever done anything mean to you, or did he make a promise and he didn't keep it? Nope. God can't break a promise. Isn't that awesome? Even if he wanted to, he couldn't. But he'll never want to because he's the opposite of that. So just like you never have to worry about this floor breaking when you walk on it because it's too strong, you never have to doubt that God is going to fail you. You don't have to treat God like broken ice. I don't know if I can trust in God. It might not work. It's always going to work. God will never break a promise to you. And his most important promise to you is what? If you trust in Jesus, he forgives all your sins and he will love you forever and take you to heaven. Isn't that a wonderful promise? You never have to worry that that's going to break. And our words today are in the psalm we read. David is in a hard place. He's sad. He's afraid. But he knows he can trust in God because God's love will never go away. Can you think about how wonderful that is and ask God to help you love him more because he loves you? Okay, thank you for listening, guys. So like I said, this psalm is not so much that you should cry out to God, although you should. And if you need convincing to do that more, let this psalm do that. But when we're crying out to God, what should our cry consist of? I think too often when we cry out to God, it's one-dimensional. When we're in the midst of a trial, it's our cry consists of one thing. End it. Make this stop, God. That's not a wrong thing. Plenty of the psalms do just that. But this psalm shows us a whole lot more ought to be going on when we're in the midst of trials, when we cry out to God. So, how should we cry out? First, this psalm shows us we should be praying for guidance. David is consumed that he be glorifying God in the midst of his trial. And so he's praying for God to teach him and guide him in the midst of it. So pray for guidance. And second, lean. Lean, lean. Write it as big as you have to. Underline it. However you know, lean on his steadfast love and mercy. Lean on his steadfast love and mercy when you're crying out to God in the midst of trials. And then finally, pray for deliverance. It's not wrong to pray that. We just can't only pray that. Pray that God delivers you from your trials. So, how does David model this idea of, in the midst of a trial, praying that God would guide him in the word so that he glorifies God? In the beginning, you see David praying that he not be put to shame. But David is the king. David is, in many ways, God's representative. David is the one who, in other psalms, people are saying, what? There's no salvation for him. God won't deliver him. And so here again, David's saying, if you don't deliver me, they drag your name through the mud. They mock you as one not worth trusting in. David's not nearly concerned about his own reputation here. He is wanting God to be glorified. And we see throughout the psalm, that could either happen if God failed, which he knows God won't do, but also if David responded poorly as one not reflecting faith in God and being a terrible witness to the Lord. So he doesn't want to be put to shame either by the enemy succeeding. So God, keep your promise, but also guide me so I respond well and be a model of what it looks like to have faith in a God who, when he puts you through trials, has not left you. That's what David wants to communicate to the world. My trials here are not a sign of God abandoning me, though that's what the world, the flesh, and the devil will say to you. And so it's a beautiful thing here that in the midst of trials, we don't know which exact trial, but people were seeking his life. It doesn't get much more dramatic than that. It's difficult things, and he's on the run. He's hungry. He's thirsty. His name is being dragged through the mud. All kinds of terrible things that he's going through. Some of them relate to things you and I have gone through. Some of them probably not so much. At least I hope you haven't been on the run for your life for years on end. Maybe some of you have, and I'm unaware. I doubt it. But regardless, even should that happen to you, it's not a sign that the Lord has left you. And the last thing we often go to, it's an opportunity. Trials are an opportunity, not just for us to be made stronger. We focus on that a lot, and that's a good thing because we forget that too. Trials strengthen us. They strengthen our faith. They sharpen us. But trials are an opportunity for us to point heavenward and glorify our Father, and that is utmost in David's concern here. And we make it evident that that's not a concern for us when in the midst of our trials we only ask, get me out of this. It's not wrong to pray that. I'm going to keep saying it throughout the sermon. Don't mishear me. I am not telling you to not ask for deliverance. That's going to be our final point, but it's got to be the final point so we get to it with the right mindset. So what does David ask for guidance? What kind of guidance is he asking for? Some of you know the grandstanding I'm about to do here because I've got a canned riff when it comes to asking God for guidance. And don't worry, I won't belabor the point. I don't want to say this in a mocking way if many of us have operated this way, because I operated this way for years, and it's crippling. When we're asking God for guidance here, we are not asking God to tell us things that aren't already in the Scriptures. God speaks to us all the time. God won't tell you anything that isn't already written down in the Bible. So the kind of guidance you should ask for is not what really honestly mirrors more pagan practices than Christian. Give me signs, God, of which college I should go to. I remember doing that. And I come home, and there's envelopes on the counter. College A was on the top. That must be God telling me that's the college I'm supposed to go to. Oh, wait a minute. It had been moved. There was actually another one on top beforehand. Oh, which one? Does the Bible ever condemn anybody for not seeking those kinds of signs? I'll save you a lot of fruitless homework. No. Does the Bible ever lay out for you, here's how you go and find out things that aren't already in the Bible. Here's the tricks you use to go see if God's telling you to take job A or job B, or marry potential spouse A, B, or C. Does that mean you shouldn't pray about those things? No, but you should pray like this. You're faced with several college options, young people. You're faced with several job options or spouse options, location options. You better be praying about those things. How? Lord, guide me so I glorify you. Keep me from a decision that would be sinful and dangerous to me. Take me to a place where I have the most opportunity to glorify you. Take me to the job where people would need my gifts the most so I could glorify you the most at that job. Provide for me, care for me, protect me. All the things the Bible tells you to pray. Often in trials, we can be saying, Lord, teach me the one thing I'm supposed to learn through some sign I'll get. Oh, this was my lesson. And then the trial can finally be done because I passed the test. Right? And I've said this to several of you who have been struggling at different times in trials, wondering, when am I going to finally learn the lesson I'm supposed to learn so it might be over? And I've had to say with as much pastoral care as I can in that moment, maybe God is using you to teach the rest of us thick-headed people as we watch you go through this. I don't know when it's going to be over. I wish I had the ability now. Sheesh. Some of you guys are going through some rough stuff, and I wish I could make it go away. I know you're not asking me to. It's just what hopefully every pastor would long he could do for those suffering. But remember, the kinds of teaching David's asking for is not show me this sign so I play this chess match with life. Let me glorify you. Teach me your word, not signs. Teach me your word. Show me your ways, David says here, so that I can glorify you. Listen to his language here. Verse 4. Make me know your ways, O Lord. Teach me your paths. Lead me in your truth and teach me, for you are the God of my salvation. For you I wait all the day long. Jump ahead to verse 8. Good and upright is the Lord. Therefore, he instructs sinners in the way. He leads the humble in what is right. He teaches the humble his way. All the paths of the Lord are steadfast love and faithfulness for those who keep his covenant and his testimonies. He's asking to be instructed in God's steadfast love and his faithfulness and his word. And that needs to be foremost in our hearts and minds when we are in the midst of trials. And I'll be the first one to tell you here, it has rarely ever been in mine. Maybe in some 20/20 hindsight, but in the thick of it, so often, if I'm praying at all, as often as I should in those moments, it's asking for simply for deliverance and not viewing this as an opportunity where God could be glorified. So, remember Deuteronomy 29:29, when you're tempted to be looking for signs instead of looking to glorify God. The secret things belong to God. The things he reveals belong to you and your children, that you may follow all the words of this law. Now, what was the only scriptures they had back then? The law. So what God is saying is this: what I want you to know, I've written down for you. Everything else, you'll find out after it happens, okay? I'm not going to tell you the future. The future you need to know, I wrote down for you. You know I'm coming again, and you're coming home with me. And you know my love will never depart from you for eternity future. That's the future you needed to know. The rest of it, I've given you a tool called wisdom. Dust that one off and start using it. Pray for how you can glorify me. Pray that I protect you. Pray that you're aware of my love in these trials. Pray that you know my word better as it applies to you in your trials. David not only asks to be taught these things, but he asks in verse 5 that God lead him in these things. And that might strike you first as lead by example. Help me be like you, God. But the leading word, the word there for leading is more like leading a child. Okay? So David asks to be taught. Guide me, teach me your truth, Lord. But then he says, but I need your strength. I need you to help me do it. It's not just that I lack knowledge, lack familiarity, I lack ability. And so if you aren't leading me like you lead a child, I'm not going to be able to traverse your paths and glorify you the way that I need to. So in the midst of trial, we are particularly aware of our weakness. Let that be a moment when you say, Lord, take my mind to your word, but then give me the ability to be walking in it too, so that I don't fall apart. Trials can be times when we either have our faith go through the roof, or we can spiral out of control into despair and doubt and cynicism and believe the world's lie that God wouldn't do this to you if he loved you. And the scriptures are replete with examples to the contrary. God's love is not being taken away, so we need him in those moments to feel that. What are his paths? All his paths are steadfast love and faithfulness. Lead me in that, and then help me walk in it. Teach it to me, and move me to follow. And so this is a pretty sober and realistic view of ourselves, I hope. It is not defeatist or pessimistic for David to say, this is how set back I am, God. It's good realism. He knows this will not happen, Lord, unless you come to where I am in the midst of my struggle and lead me out. It's not going to happen. I don't have the ability to climb out myself. So the kind of obedience, the kind of God-glorifying obedience that God wants from us in the midst of our trials, that they are an opportunity for us to give him. David summarizes in verse 9, he leads the humble in what is right. He teaches the humble his way. There's a good, faith-enriched humility that is incredibly glorifying to God at any time, but particularly in our trials. And it's very hard for us in the midst of our trials, particularly if your trials consist of, where so many of ours do, being mistreated, dealing with the sin of other people. And that's very much what David's trials are consisting of. People want to kill David, and he's innocent. You don't get much more mistreated than that. And so often when we are being mistreated, humility is the farthest thing from us, because even though we are the innocent party in the mix, what's the only thing we're thinking about? But I didn't do anything wrong. They're the ones who are wrong, but I'm the one who's right. I'm the one who's right. I'm the one who's right. It's very hard to beat that drum and have an ounce of humility about you. And I know it well, because I am Buddy Rich on that drum, okay? So a humility in the midst of being mistreated like that says, God is the reason why I have any hope. God is the one who has promised me my future is secure. Then what can man do? I'm still going to ask God to have this stop, but why should I spiral out of control, be eaten alive by the anger of these false accusations when I'm the one who didn't do anything wrong? Look at how you get wrapped around that axle. And now you're really doing plenty wrong. Okay. Why not say, God be the one, if I need vindication, God's going to be the one to do it. And on the last day, if people go to their graves thinking, I am guilty of X, Y, or Z, God's the one on the last day who's going to point to me and say something I don't deserve to hear. Because while I might be innocent of this crime, I'm far more guilty than anyone knows of a million other ones. And God's still going to say, well done, good and faithful servant. So why would I get eaten alive by this need to exonerate myself from whatever it is they're saying? It doesn't matter. God will vindicate me. I would rather be humble and say, God, how can I glorify you in the midst of this mistreatment? How can I make it about you and stop making it all about me? So, we desperately need to be clinging to him in our trials, otherwise we spiral out of control. But what's the one thing David goes to now to help you be humble, help you be the humble, trusting person who wants to glorify him in trial instead of making it all about you? Because David knows we desperately need his mercy. People who are in desperate need of God's mercy cannot be up there pounding their chest saying, look how good I am. Look at what an innocent party I am in this mess. Can you believe how mistreated I am? People who desperately need God's mercy the way we do have no business making that claim and staking our hope on it for crying out loud. So David goes now in this psalm to leaning on God's steadfast love and his mercy. You might notice that we're jumping around in this psalm to kind of at the beginning and the end to collect themes. That's because this is arranged poetically. It's actually an acrostic with most of the Hebrew alphabet. Some of the letters didn't cut it, so he had to kind of go for most of it. But he's stacking some of the same things at the beginning and the end kind of artistically. So we're going to grab them at the end and beginning and pull them together here to view them each together. So David has been asking for the ability to follow the Lord's wisdom, follow the word, be taught, and he realizes, not only do I need to be taught and I need to be guided because I don't have the ability, but I desperately need to be focusing on how much mercy I need for you in the midst of my trial here. So far from, oh yeah, if you love me, you wouldn't make me go through this, God, David's not going there at all. There's other times when he asks those questions. Sometimes his trials bring him to flirt with that question. But here David is saying, without your mercy, I don't have any hope. So look at verse 6. Remember your mercy, O Lord, and your steadfast love, for they have been from of old. That phrase just gives me goosebumps. And every single English translation I looked at translates it the same way. Even recent NIV translations still go from of old. And it is this just powerful statement. It should kind of land with a thud, right? The idea of you look at a mountain that you know cannot be moved. That's the idea. Your promises predate time. They are more powerful than anything. Nothing can touch them. And if you have promised like that in your covenant to be merciful to me, nothing can move that. And I'm going to lean on that right now because everything else in my life is falling apart. It's all showing its temporal and risky nature. Kids, sometimes the rest of your life is going to feel like breaking ice. It feels like nothing you can stand on. But you can always rely on God's promises because he'll never, ever take away his love. Don't forget that. And so, he says, remember not the sins of my youth, nor my transgressions, according to your steadfast love, remember me for the sake of your goodness. So David knows in the midst of his trial, he still has this is a foreshadowing, not literal foreshadowing, but prone to wander, Lord, I fear it, prone to leave the God I love. David knows his tendencies. And so he remembers times he's done it in the past. He knows he has the tendency to do it again in the future in the midst of a trial. So Lord, please remember not my sins. And he has the gall to say, Remember me, though. Remember not my sins. Remember me. Is David daring to ask God to separate the sin from the sinner? The thing you say God doesn't do for those, you know. He goes, oh, God loves everyone. He just separates the sin from the sinner. No. God punishes sinners. Is David daring to ask God to separate the sin from him? Yes. That is what David is doing. Because that is what God does for all of his children. He doesn't do it for those who are not his children. But as we read today from our declaration of forgiveness, he separates them. He remembers them no more. As far as the east is from the west. Picture that image of the scapegoat on the Day of Atonement. Here is your sin. It's going on the goat and it's gone. That's what David's asking God to do for him. And I hope that is what all of you ask God to do on a regular basis. Not to get him to do so because it's already done, but so that you dwell on the fact that it's done. He's not waiting there holding the goat back until you ask him to ask for it. And then, okay, let it go. All right. Don't forget to ask him to do that. No. You're asking God to do this because it's already done and you don't focus on it enough. And the more you focus on the fact that his mercy has paid for your sin once and for all, and you get the idea that these ones from David's youth, this is not childhood. This is more young, overzealous adulthood, okay? These are things still haunting David. These are places where the devil's got a great angle for his darts of attack. And they're haunting David, and he knows he's got the tendency to do them again. Lord, help me remember. They're gone. But you, Lord, here's what I'm going to ask you to do it. Don't remember what I've done. Remember me, separate from that, and according to your steadfast love. Again, remember, that is covenant language. It's what God's sworn to do. David is relying on God's covenant promise. He's not coming up with some new thing he hopes God's willing to do if he just shoots for the moon and maybe God will honor it. This is from of old. This is what God said he was going to do, and it's unbreakable. Maybe you've noticed times when God providentially aligns our worship. I've written those orders of worship out. There's 26 of them. I wrote them when we first started the church, and we do them in order twice a year, okay? So I did not plan that our call to worship would be from Psalm 136 that repeats, your steadfast love endures forever. But boy, did that work out great this week, didn't it? And God does that so often. David is asking God simply to keep his unbreakable word. Why do you have to ask God to do that? Not to get God to do it, to remind us that it's unbreakable. And when in times of trial is when you are tempted to think most of all that maybe that was a bogus promise. Maybe God makes those, but it's for people who qualify. Particularly when your sin is a result, your trial is a result of your own sin. And again, even though David is being wrongfully treated, sometimes his trials are the result of his sin. But he still knows he can cling to God's unbreakable word to redeem him and love him forever. So David's not asking for some cheap grace, get out of jail free card here. And I don't want to encourage you guys to do that either. He's going to ancient promises that are unbreakable so that God is glorified. Remember, deliver me so that people realize trusting in you pays off. Trusting in you always succeeds. Not that I always succeed, but that your promises always preserve, always complete what they've said they're going to do. And then people will see that you should be trusted in and not in themselves. That's what David wants. So not only does this help David deal with kind of his demons of the past that he's being haunted with, it gives him confidence for the future. You forgave me for those things. They're done. Then I know even if I fail in the future, you're not going to fail me. And that's what we need, especially in times of trial. Confidence for the future. So David could say, my soul will abide in well-being. My family will dwell in the land. Is that David having recently watched some televangelist preachers and being convinced he should do some naming it and claiming it? Is David all of a sudden kind of drunk on his own confidence? No. This is the confidence that God produces when he's led us to feed on his promises. It gives you strength. And it gives you a strength of hope in the future that what matters most won't be taken away from you. Even if this world continues to deal you hands that just hurt and fail. And you keep stumbling in your struggle against your own sin. You know the future is still sure for you because it depends on him. So when you are struggling, remember, you need to trust in his steadfast love so that you don't despair. Because you'll be led to think this is a sign of his lack of love for you. But remember to trust in his steadfast mercy because that's what will keep you humble in the midst of this. Pride looks at God and says, this trial is far worse than I deserve. You have wronged me. And that just makes things way worse because then you are embittered and you do begin the spiral of despair. But the humility that is we are exhorted to here in this passage today is fueled by remembering, no, God can't wrong me. And though people are wronging me right now, God didn't promise me he would protect me from that. He's not breaking promises to me. He told me the world would hate me. He told me this would be a difficult journey. But his love will not depart from me. So I'm not going to read God the Riot Act and demand better. I'm going to ask him to preserve me. I'm going to ask him to guide me so I can glorify him in the midst of this. Remember his steadfast love. Lean on it. This is not being taken from you. Lean on his mercy also so we can humbly respond in a way that loves him in times of trial. After that, you've asked God to guide you. You have leaned on his steadfast love and mercy. What should you do? The psalm shows you. Ask for deliverance. God nowhere tells you to seek a life of difficulty. He warns you it's probably coming. He warns you that his name invites that and you bear his name. But God never tells you to seek trial. Sure, meet challenges in good God-honoring ways. I remember as being a younger a Christian, being surrounded by other young, zealous, perhaps overzealous Christians, chests puffed out in some kind of crazy bonfire, prayer, shaman circle, I don't know. God, I want trials. I want trials so I can glorify you. I remember thinking, like, I'm afraid I'm going to tiptoe away here because I think the trial might come while I'm standing here. It is not wrong. It is not weak faith for you to beg God, get me out of this, please. Lead me not into temptation. Deliver me from evil. Provide for me. And the Lord's Prayer is full of these petitions. Whether it is material suffering, spiritual suffering, whatever, this psalm is absolute blank check for you to shoot for the moon and beg God to deliver you. You know what I always say when it comes to that? What's the craziest prayer request in all the Bible? Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane dares ask God if there's plan B is an option. You know that thing we swore before the foundation of the world? Back before we created time and all that? Can we try something else? Is there another way? That wasn't sinful. Why? Because he still wanted God to be glorified the most. Lord, if there's any other way out, please, but not my will, yours be done. If Jesus is allowed, so are you. I think often, because we don't approach God bolstered by a desire to glorify him and bolstered by his steadfast love and mercy, we only pray for the deliverance, but we do it anemically. God, make a stop. Please. Instead of coming out here boldly, like Christ, saying, Lord, I am asking you, glorify yourself in me and get me out. Make it stop. Don't hear me saying that God answers once your faithometer is high enough, all right? I'm not saying that. The Bible nowhere says that either. But is it glorifying to God to pray stoked by his covenant promises so your faith is richly in him and desiring his glory? Yes, that's right for us. We're not doing it to get the answer we want. We're doing it because it's right and it's beautiful. And what does it show the watching world? My trials are a reason for me to cling all the more strongly to my Father, not to run away from him. You may mock and say it's a sign of his lack of love. I know he can't take it away, so this is not what's happening. He's promised me he's going to use these to help me, and I want to use it to glorify him. So listen to what David says in verse 15. My eyes are ever toward the Lord, for he will pluck my feet out of the net. Turn to me and be gracious to me, for I am lonely and afflicted. The troubles of my heart are enlarged. Bring me out of my distresses. Consider my affliction and my trouble, and forgive all my sins. Consider how many are my foes, and with what violent hatred they hate me. Oh, guard my soul and deliver me. Let me not be put to shame, for I take refuge in you. May integrity and uprightness preserve me, for I wait for you. Redeem Israel, O God, out of all his troubles. So, he has no pride also prohibiting him from calling out. Pride will rid God the riot act, and pride will act like it doesn't need any help too. Sometimes we'll pray to God, we won't admit to our brothers and sisters we need help. He's put us here to help. David is humbly saying, I don't have what it takes, God. And I know I'm sinning in this. I still need forgiveness. But I'm lonely. I'm afflicted. Help. Cry out to God like that. Please see where David ends here. He's ending, continuing to honor the Lord, worshiping the Lord, saying, I will wait on the Lord all the day long. I'm not turning away. I am saying my hope, he is my refuge. So he's worshiping God. But has David gotten his answer yet? No. Remember last week in Psalm 3, David said, I cried out to the Lord and he answered me. And sometimes that happens. Sometimes he doesn't answer either the way you want or doesn't answer when you wanted him to. That's where David is right now. There hasn't been an answer. But that does not make him waver. In fact, it makes him all the more convinced he's not letting go. And if David should let go, how far away is he getting? When you let go of God, you're going nowhere. You make it more difficult for yourself. We all do. But you can't let go and drop from God's radar. You can't let go and all of a sudden you're not there where he can be caring for you again. David's biggest concern in this still is his potential to sin. More than his current circumstances. God's glory matters more to him than his current circumstances. So he still asks God for deliverance, but longs that he would, more than anything else, glorify him. He asks for God to preserve him with integrity and uprightness, not meaning David's own integrity and uprightness preserve him, but he knows his tendency to fall away, so he's asking God, let me remain there so I'm glorifying you. Should I turn from you, then all their accusations are proved right. Preserve me in integrity and uprightness so that I can glorify you. Brothers and sisters, this sermon was not the main point, go be like David. Because none of us can exhibit that the way that we should. The point of this is, the way David cries out is the way God is calling you to cry out. Why? Because that's the way you receive the strength you need in the midst of a trial. Don't give in to the doubt of the world. Don't give in to the entitlement that your flesh wants you to have when you're going through a trial. Cry out to God so that you can be taught by him, glorify him, and then realize you need to lean more than ever on his love and his mercy for you, because you will have a tendency to be faithless and to sin and accuse and doubt. And then bolstered by the fact that you know he loves you, cry out all the more that God deliver you, that he make you feel his love, that it be palpable to you, so you won't be struggling with doubt. So you can say with David, Lord, I'm not turning away. I'm not finding alternatives. I'm not going to give in. I know you won't fail me. And when I fail, I know you're not going to let me go. So I'm going to wait. And I'm going to worship and beg you to give me joy in the midst of my trial.